This is a production of Cornell University.
So I'd like to welcome you to the second of this year's, this semester's Messenger Lectures. The third one, let me remind you at the beginning, will be tomorrow afternoon at 4:45. As I said yesterday, I wanted to say a few words about the series itself. The series is supported by an endowment from the estate of H.J. Messenger, Jr., who was a member of the Cornell class of 1880. The usual literature about him says he was a longtime teacher of mathematics. A variety of reasons I was skeptical about this. His estate gave in 1923 the equivalent of $880,000 today to support these lectures. It was a $74,000 bequest. So I went and looked a little bit about him and found that the university keeps files on all of its alumni, be warned, and then once they die, these go to the deceased alumni files, which are down below the ground in Kroc Library. And I got the deceased alumni file of Hiram John Messenger, Jr., and it's sort of an interesting story. He got a bachelor's in B.Litt in 1880. He came from Cortland, where, right nearby, where his father was a banker. He founded the H.J. Messenger Bank of Cortland and Marathon, which you might think would explain how he could give such a prize. But I think, from what I could read, it looks like the bank didn't do so well in the years after the Civil War. But before that, Messenger Sr. had a lot to do with the building of downtown Cortland, such as it is. And so young Hiram John Messenger, after graduating from Cornell, returned to Cortland for 1 year and taught as a professor of mathematics at the State Normal School at Cortland, which is now SUNY Cortland. After this 1 year, he went west and to Napa College in Napa, California, which eventually became the College of the Pacific in Stockton, which is now part of the University of the Pacific. And he taught there 2 years, also as a professor of mathematics. Then he returned to Cornell as a graduate student in mathematics, and in 1886 received a PhD in mathematics, which was the second PhD in mathematics given by this university. The first went to one Henry T. Eddy, who may or may not have his name on Eddy Street, but was a very successful mathematician anyhow, and Eddy does have his name on a building at the University of Minnesota where he ended his career. Anyway, Messenger, after getting his PhD on modern methods and conics, I think is what his thesis title was, moved to New York and became an acting associate professor of mathematics. You see, a PhD got him a lower title. He became an acting associate professor of mathematics at the University of the City of New York, which was the early name for NYU. And he taught there for 4 years. So his math teaching career was not long-term, it was 7 years. In 1891, he became an actuarial clerk at the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company in New York and was in this position for 7 years, and then moved to Hartford and became an actuary with the Travelers Insurance Company, where he completed his career. During this time, he lectured extensively and wrote various things. Apparently, he had worked for Travelers. He did work in finance, various ways. He wrote a pamphlet on different methods proposed for valuing the marketable securities held by life insurance companies. And he went on to become a pioneer in the field of health insurance, of all things. He wrote a pamphlet on health insurance in the United States in 1903. Anyway, he died in 1913, and his estate didn't pay Cornell, I presumably it was paying other people in the meantime, until 1924. There's an article in the, 1923, in the October 12th, 1923 Ithaca Journal, It was reported that at the trustees meeting in Buffalo, the president reported this gift of $74,000. And it says the income of the fund is to be used to provide a course or courses of lectures on the evolution of civilization for the special purpose of raising the moral standard of our political, business, and social life. These lectures are to be known as the Messenger Lectures on the Evolution of Civilization. So the tail end of the title seems to have been lost over the years, but I think it's pretty apt that the first of the things that he had chosen that lecture should be on was raising the moral standards of our political life. And this series of lectures is exactly about our political life and how it interacts with our mathematical way of reasoning about it. Our speaker, I'll introduce him again briefly, is Michel Bolinski from Ecole Polytechnique, who, as I mentioned, is an American mathematician, so was qualified to complain about the American political system, even though he has worked in France. He was born in Geneva, Switzerland, to Polish parents who were there because his maternal grandfather, Ludwig Reichmann, was a Polish diplomat who headed the health section of the League of Nations. After the war, Reichmann came to New York and went to the United Nations, and he went on to be the founder of UNICEF. Bolinski received he moved to the U.S. at a young age and received his entire education in this country and worked here for a few decades before moving to France in 1980. His lecture today is about voting systems and voting, you know, how to choose a winner from many candidates. It's based on his forthcoming book with Rita Laraki of Ecole Polytechnique called One Value, One Vote, Measuring, Electing, and Ranking. In this book, they achieve a result which basically counters the various paradoxes of social choice theory, this well-known Arrow's paradox, which say you can't have a reasonable voting system. Apparently, this is not so. This result of Bolinski and Laraki has been hailed as a major breakthrough in the area of voting and social choice, and we'll soon hear about it. Michelle?
Thank you very much, Lou. It's a pleasure, as I said yesterday, to be here and to be able to talk about these problems. And of course, I feel very honored to have been invited to do so. I would like this talk, as Lou said, is entirely based on joint work with Rita Laraki. And what I'm going to do, of course, since I'm trying to do this to a wide audience, is to emphasize the applied character of the thing. But of course, there are, and I will point this out as we go through, there are theorems and mathematics behind it which characterize the methods about which I'll be talking. I'm going to start very quickly, simply to put up three or four slides that I put up at the beginning yesterday, because this is a series of talks. So the first one, which I gave yesterday, had to do with the apportioning seats. This is old work that was done with Peyton Young. The second, now, which I will be talking with you about today, is why the first past the post method of electing one among several candidates is seriously defective, and this somehow will get us into the subject matter, and then see what we can do about it. And then tomorrow, I would like to talk with you about a scheme for circumventing gerrymandering. Now, again, just to put the context, this is in the context of saying we all claim to live in democracies. France is a democracy, England is a democracy, the United States is a democracy, and one asks the question, yeah, but exactly how democratic is this? And I think there are very serious problems in all of these countries and others. In fact, almost every place that I've looked at, where really one can say, my God, this is not reasonable representation. And here, There's presidency I don't need to talk about. I just did this computation the other day. Senate is really just so lopsided that it's absolutely incredible from the point of view of representation. And you get this also from the point of view of political representation, as is this 51 Democratic senators representing 58% of the population, as versus 49 Republicans who represent 42. And I will argue tomorrow with some facts that it is entirely possible, and I suspect has often happened, that a minority of the population has elected a majority of the House of Representatives. Well, that seems, so how representative is all of this? Now, nothing different in the UK. Again, I'm sorry for those of you I'm repeating here, but you take the last six elections, you've never had a party who entered with a majority of the vote. They always had a minority, but a large majority in the seats, particularly in 2005, which was hailed as a wonderful grand victory for Tony Blair. But he got a third of a vote, 35.2, as versus the Conservatives, who got a third also, but just a little bit less. In France, the situation is just as bad, but in different ways. There is manipulation of the voting rules very consistently. There are changes in one aspect or another of the electoral code in all of the years that I've listed here. And this last table of four numbers is just to give you a sense of how different the congressional districts are in population. And they're meant to be defined in terms of population. So you see, over the entire country, the second of Lozère is the smallest. The second of Val d'Oise is the largest. We're talking about a factor 5.5 to 1. Whereas, and of course, that has two aspects. It's because of apportioning seats to each of the departments. That's the first decision. Then it's cut up. So these two numbers on the left have two components of inequity, if you wish. One comes from the apportionment, the other comes from the districting, from the cutting up of the districts. Whereas on the right, we're in the same department of Var, and there you get a factor of 2.4 approximately. So you see, it's really, really quite bad. Okay. So the problem we're going to face today, or to raise today, is how to elect, and I will put in the same boat how to rank. Now, incidentally, in the theory of social choice, these are two very, very different problems. And we have a theorem, which I won't go into these talks, which basically says the following thing. If you want certain properties, where you have people saying, I have a rank ordering of competitors. So I have each of us, we're all in this room, we each have there's some competition going on, and each of us makes a rank ordering of the competitors, and from that, and this is the basic problem of theory of social choice, we want to get a common ranking. Okay, now, you take a common set of axioms, of properties that you want this to satisfy, and you apply it to saying, I want to get a ranking over all competitors. And you also apply it to, I want to designate a winner. And the result basically is this. It says, well, in that case, you're going to have to be satisfied with saying, Mr. A is the winner. Mr. A is first, Mr. B is second, Mr. C is third, Mr. D. This is a men's competition in this example. But the winner is Mr. C. That is, there is not an accord between the first in the ranking and a winner. There's an essential contradiction. All right. So, rhetorically, are elected presidents those wished by the voters? And I would say that, that's our problem today. So we want to choose one candidate, or we want to get a ranking, among several. And of course, what do? We have a mechanism for doing this. Mechanisms, the usual mechanisms, do they do the job well? I mean, you know what the mechanism is for the US presidency. It's an electoral college, and of course, as we all know, it may well elect somebody who does not have a majority of the votes. This happened in 1876, happened in 1888. As you know, it happened in 2000. And but we can look more closely and ask one of the reasons why it happened in 2000. And that is, at least one reason can be given, is that Ralph Nader was a candidate in Florida. He got 97,488 votes. Florida had 25 electoral votes. It's quite clear that had Nader not been there, most of those votes would have gone to Gore. He would have carried Florida, and therefore he would have been president, without talking about all the Chads and all the rest of that. So this is precisely a violation of Kenneth Arrow's famous independence of irrelevant alternatives condition. What does it say? It says that we're interested in who's first between, say, two major candidates, in this case Bush and Gore. And the presence of a third candidate can flip this decision one way or another. But this is a condition that seems to be really very difficult to accept. And of course, I will give you Arrow's theorem in a minute. It is something that is violated by every method that has and is being used to elect people. Now, I'm going to do everything in the context of the French presidential election because the examples are extremely useful to be able to illustrate the things I would like to say. And the Constitution of the Fifth Republic says, the president of the republic is elected by the absolute majority of the votes. If it is not obtained in the first round of the election, then a second round is held 2 weeks later, always a Sunday. The only two candidates who may present themselves after the eventual withdrawal of more favored candidates, that has never occurred, are those who have the largest number of votes in the first round. So there now we no electoral college to mess things up. And now let's first of all look at this famous election of 2002, where you all know the extreme right candidate, Jean-Marie Le Pen, survived into the second round. Here are the votes in the first round. So as you see, I mean, it's very, very flat. Chirac, who was the standing president, only got just slightly, didn't even get 20% of the vote. Jospin, of course, was the standing prime minister, socialist. Everybody expected the second round to be between Jospin and Chirac, but here's what happened. Of course, we have here 16 candidates. Now, second round, overwhelmingly for Chirac, because overwhelmingly, to be more honest, against Le Pen. As you can see, Chirac barely got 20% of the votes, didn't even get the 20% in the first round. Now, let's look at this and ask several questions. Chevènement, who picked up 5.33%, he was a socialist, and clearly took away some of the socialist votes. It seems quite reasonable that had he not been there, several percent of those votes at least would have gone to Jospin. It seems quite clear that Jospin would have survived to the second term, and the vote would have been between Chirac and Jospin. Now, less known, perhaps, but there was a candidate by the name of Taubira, She also was a socialist, and she obtained, now wait a second, where are we? Taubira, as you see, she's down in the last row here on the left, she obtained 2.32% of the vote, very little. However, she offered to withdraw from the first term, and socialists refused, she offered to withdraw on the condition that her expenses would be covered, and the socialists refused to do that, so she stayed in. I've learned subsequently how should I put this to make sure that I'm not in some sense lying? I've been assured by people who I think should know, two people, in particular one who used to be the head of the second television station in France, that it was well known that Chirac supported her candidacy. At the same time, there is an ally of Chirac by the name of Pasqua, who had been Minister of the Interior, who was a very close ally of Chirac across the years. He had said he would run. And then, at any rate, he said he would and then he didn't. Why, I'm unable to say. But now I postulate, suppose he had, and Taubira, and he replaced Taubira, and Taubira withdrawn. Well, then what would have happened? It seems quite clear that most of Taubira's votes would have gone to Jospin. Jospin would have some, and Pasqua would have taken away some of the votes of Chirac, and it would be totally possible for this to have occurred, which would then mean that it would be Jospin against Le Pen at the second term, and therefore, quite clearly, Jospin would have won by a very large margin. So what's the point? The point is that we have here a vicious occurrence of the relevance of irrelevant alternatives. That is, here are clearly irrelevant alternatives. Taubira, Pasqua, Chevènement had absolutely no chance of being elected, but they could have a very strong influence on the election. Now, of course, these examples prove that with the two-round first-past-the-post system, the presence or absence of unelectable candidates can determine the outcome. And, of course, this is a violation of Arrow's condition. Now we're going to come to this last election, and, of course, election of 202 had a big impact in France. People very aware of what had happened. And obviously, the value of the votes given to Chirac, it was not as though 82% of the population wanted Chirac as president. Here's the first round result of the 2007 election. Now, and here's the second round. As you know, Sarkozy was elected. Now, there are lots of very interesting things about this election. First of all, as I just suggested, the lessons of 2002 were very present in the spirits of people, therefore very high participation, and I believe more strategic voting, more realization that maybe you should not vote your conviction, maybe you should vote otherwise, because you don't want to have the kind of occurrence you had 5 years before. Secondly, it seems very clear that there is one candidate who would have beaten every other one in a direct confrontation. All the polls showed this. I'm showing you one poll, and that is François Bayrou. Bayrou, in this particular poll, 3 weeks before the first round, was shown beating Le Pen by 84% of the vote, Ségolène Royal by 57, and Sarkozy by 54. This was consistent for the last, every time this kind of a poll was done, the same qualitative results occurred. One of the reasons is that of those who were for Royal, 72% they would prefer Bayrou to Sarkozy, and of those who voted for who said they were voting for Sarkozy, 75% said they would vote for Bayrou against Wayad. So he was picking up all of those from both sides. Of course, this shows what, if we believe this, the French electoral system, in fact, any first-past-the-post system, can fail to elect the so-called Condorcet winner, being one who beats every other candidate. Now, of course, I haven't done the table for the other candidates. There's not much point. Again, who beats each one in a head-to-head confrontation. So you're not being confused by other candidacies. Now, let's look at the traditional view of the theory of social choice. Traditionally, commonly, I would say, and in theory, a voter is assumed to have a list of candidates in his or her mind, ordered from best to worst. Now, we say, and when I say we, it's not the royal we, it's Hida Lahaki and I, we say that is nonsense. And I can give you two instances of why, give you two proofs of the nonsense. First, the old system for judging figure skating, I know probably many of you watched it on television, and it gave you very, in some sense, it misled people as to thinking about how the system worked. Judges announced scores, 9.1, 9.8, or whatever it might be. And then immediately the television people would take averages and say who's ahead of whom and so on and so forth. But that's not the way the numbers were used. If a judge gave a 9.8, that number was remembered till the end of everybody's performance. And it was used only for one purpose. It was to order the candidates according to him. So his grades were not used as grades. They were simply used as a input of a rank ordering of the performers. Okay? So now what does that say? Well, it's just too damn difficult to write down a rank ordering of the competitors. There might be 20 competitors. How are you going to keep track of who's going to be where and where you're going to slip them in and all that? Much easier to give scores. That's first. So it's not practical. Secondly, let's take politics. 12 candidates this year in France. 5 years ago, as you saw, 16. No one had a rank ordering on the 12 or 16 candidates. What do you think? Well, there are a bunch of candidates. I would never consider them. The hell with them, I forget them. Then there's some candidates. Maybe I have a preference. Maybe I have a second preference. But of course, I have intensities of preferences, but certainly it's not a rank ordering. And thirdly, I will tell you about an experiment shortly where we tried a method and where implicitly what happened, we asked people to grade. I'll come to that in a moment. That's what our approach does. And it was extremely telling because a third, a little over a third of the voters in our experiment gave the highest grade possible to at least two candidates. So they did not even want to make a choice, a single choice. They preferred saying it's all two candidates or three are my top choice. So I say that is nonsense. Now, secondly, I would like to give a little bit of the background, a flavor of social choice in order to be able to explain what Arrow's theorem says. And the first, of course, departing point is that there may be no Condorcet winner. And here's an example. And what these numbers say here is this, that if I take A against B, that is, A against B, he gets 29% from the first list, right? And plus 38 from the second list, that's 67%. So A beats B with 67% of the vote. B beats C with 61%, and C beats A with 70%. And of course, this is the famous Condorcet paradox. In fact, Condorcet was preceded by Raymond Lull, who proposed a more refined idea in 1299, where, though he does not say in what he writes that he has recognized that there could be a Condorcet paradox, but his method was to do the following thing. Give to every candidate a point for each candidate he defeats in a head-to-head race. If they're tied, a point to both. Then elect the candidate with the most points. That, if there is one candidate who beats all the others head-to-head, that is a Condorcet winner, obviously he will have the most points. But maybe we don't have that, so this is a more general rule. This is today known as Copeland's method, attributed to Copeland. This is 1951. Now, there are a lot of objections we can make about this approach, and I will not, you know, I'm not going to try to make a whole big story, but I would simply like to take two concepts and show that there is an essential contradiction. Suppose that we have 3N voters, 300 voters, who have the following, list. That is, 100 of them prefer A to B to C, then 100 prefer B to C to A, and another 100 C to A to B. And you see, this is cyclic. So A is in first place, each of them is in the first place, second place, and third place as often as the others. So there's a perfect symmetry between them. And what can we conclude from this? Well, quite an obvious thing, that collectively, what do these 3N voters say? That the three candidates are tied. Or another way of saying it, their opinions cancel each other out, so we can forget them. The others will decide. So now look at this example. Suppose the electorates lists are as follows. Okay, so here are the six possible orderings of preferences. And notice then that on the left, I can take out, I can let my N be 13%. I can take them out. And on the right, I can let my N be 4%. I can take them out. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of my story. I can do that, but we'll do that in a second. But if I look at this particular problem, then the Condorcet winner is A. A gets 51% against B, and he gets 70% against C. But if I take out the 39, the N equal 13 on the left, and the N equal 4 on the right, I'm left with a problem in red. And I ask you to look at the problem in red. Who's the obvious winner? Well, C is dead last, and B certainly beats A. Whereas, what is the Condorcet winner? He's A. So by adding, you know, by the presence or absence of quote-unquote preferences, that is, and I don't like that word, but ordered lists that are canceling each other out, you determine whether you get the, I mean, that determines the Condorcet winner one way or the other. That says this notion is not necessarily the right one. Of course, it could be the right candidate, but in the literature and in the concept of people, the notion of the Condorcet winner is the strongest one that has survived. And it continues to be talked about, and yet I think it is a perfectly flawed idea. Okay, now in 1433, and incidentally, one of the reasons that I want to emphasize this age is that people have been thinking about this problem in the same way since 1299. That is, rank orderings. It's always making comparisons with no weights involved, no nothing. It's just a rank ordering. Nicholas Cusanos proposed then what is known as Borda's method. That is, It works as follows. A voter, you know, each, again, come back to the situation, we have these lists. A voter contributes K border points to a candidate if he prefers that candidate to K others. And so, you know, we look at everybody's lists, and there, each candidate gets a certain number of points by this process. The one with the most points wins. A candidate's border count is the sum of the border points, as I've said. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. And the border ranking ranks the candidates according to their border counts. Now, obviously, this method, the cyclical things, it washes them out, right? Because everybody appears in that, say, in the first position the same number of times and so on, so they're going to get the same number of points. So it will not change when you add one of these Condorcet components or not. It clearly cancels properly. On the other hand, look at this example. Suppose the electorate's lists are this. Now we'll see that border's winners are not necessarily legitimate. The border winner here is A, because the border ranking is as I've given it. For example, A's border count is what? Well, he's on the left, I put him in red. So A beats two people in the first 33%, so that gives him 2 times 33, then he gets 2 times 16, and then he's in second place for 30%. So his border count is 128, B's is 117, and C's is 55. But if C withdraws, and C is just the last candidate, right? What happens? Well, things turn around. B becomes the border winner. So the fact of C being last, if you drop him, then we change the result. That, again, it's a violation of Arrow's independence of irrelevant alternatives. The presence or absence of C determines the election. This is unavoidable in the traditional model. If voters truly have lists in their minds and they can do whatever they like, if when one candidate is the first on everyone's list, then that candidate must be elected. And finally, if winners do not change because of some irrelevant candidacy, then Arrow's impossibility, there isn't any method of election that does this. Now, this has usually been interpreted as meaning there can be no satisfactory mechanism for amalgamating the wants, wishes, or opinions of an electorate. And politicians are very pleased with this result because that lets them manipulate as much as they want and try to, you know, change things in order to suit themselves. Nevertheless, today, the debate goes on in voting theory. It gives the Condorcet winner a place of honor. Others are arguing for border as the method to be used. Sometimes the two are convoluted into a Baroque marriage of incompatible ideas. For example, this suggestion has been repeatedly made, if there is no Condorcet winner, then you should use Borda's method. As a matter of fact, Borda's method was used to elect members of the French Academy of Sciences from about 1794 until 1800, when a newly elected member, Napoleon Bonaparte, insisted it be abandoned. Because of its manipulability. And here, Laplace is the man who really pointed this out very distinctly. He had imagined that they give number grades to candidates. And then he did a probabilistic analysis to justify Borda's method, but afterwards rejected it. And here's what he said. Borda's method would be without a doubt the best if considerations alien to the merit of a candidate did not influence the choice of the electors, even the most honest ones, and did not determine them to rank last the most dangerous opponents to their favorites. Indeed, in the traditional model, where again it is assumed that voters have lists, manipulability is unavoidable. This is the famous theorem of Gebhardt Satterthwaite, which says there is no method, for which a voter's best strategy is to vote his convictions. And of course, you know, when, especially in a popular election, that's what people want to do. That seems very clear. And so our conclusion is, well, look, thinking about voters or judges and thinking that they rank order, it's just a bad model. First of all, in practice, and we've looked at practice, we've looked at piano competitions, we've looked at wine competitions, I'll come to wine a little later, we've looked at skating, gymnastics, diving, that's not what they do. What do they all do? They give scores. And so now I will describe to you our the translation of this into an experiment that we conducted in the first round of the French presidential election this year. Now we begin, this is exactly the ballot that people had to vote in. I will give you the French translations in a second. But what I want to, I mean, for those of you who read French, and this, we thought about this statement a very long time. And I would like to say right away that it was quite influential. We think it's very important to address a question. And this was very much initially motivated by Ramon Llull's charge in 1299. It is necessary, he said, to ascertain that in the election three things should be considered, of which the first is honesty and holiness of life, the second is knowledge and wisdom, and the third is a suitable disposition of the heart. Each person having a vote in the chapter should take an oath by the Holy Gospels of God to consider these three things and to always elect the person in whom they are best embodied. You know, the thing that struck me in reading this was I wondered, what would a modern voter do were he confronted with such a statement, translated, of course, into more into terms that would be more acceptable? Maybe people would really vote differently. Well, here's the translation of then of our ballot. To be president of France, having taken into account all considerations, I judge, in conscience, that this candidate would be, and now you had to say either excellent, very good, good, acceptable, poor, or to be rejected. Now, I'm not sure these are the good words in English. They are excellent for French because excellent, very good, good, the exact terms we had in French, excellent, very good, good, acceptable, poor, are the grades given to all French schoolchildren. Everybody knows what these means. These constitute a common language of evaluation. One thing that was added was to be rejected. So candidates were asked to check for each candidate, say, give a grade, and it was explicitly said that if there was no check, then that meant the candidate is to be rejected. All right, so what is this point of view? Voters here do not vote, they evaluate. And I underline they evaluate with a common language of grades, as Laplace had originally imagined. A candidate's set of grades determines that candidate's what we call majority grade. I'll come to it in a moment as to how it's defined. And it is, if you wish, the final grade that is conferred upon the candidate by the electorate. The candidates are ranked according to their majority grades, and the first among them is the winner. Finally, when two candidates have the same majority grade, then there is a procedure which will always rank one ahead of the other unless both have an exactly identical set of grades. Consequence, this method, we call this the majority judgment, satisfies Arrow's independence of relevant alternatives. Why? Because the grades belong to the candidate. And whether there's another candidate who withdraws or does not withdraw, it doesn't change anything. So it automatically satisfies that. As a practical matter, we believe it is very important to pose a clear question, that by and large people try to answer the question, that this common language, again, is absolutely essential. And from this point of view of this language, in the new theory, Arrow's impossibility theorem says something very important. It says, without a common language, there can be no consistent collective decision. So it plays a very important role here. Now, you know, a lot of people say, yeah, but of course these common languages don't exist. You know, I have one professor here who's very harsh and another who's not, and so on. You never get anything together. Well, as a matter of practice, we have observed that this is not true. Common languages do exist. When you look at diving, you look at skating, you look at a lot of sporting competitions, they all use scores. Piano competitions do too, they always use scores. And you can observe that when somebody says, this is a performance that's worth 9.2, everybody knows what that means. Don't necessarily agree, but they know what it means. Now look, it's not perfect. Lou will tell me that's blue, and I say, and I don't see the blue, that the color is blue. I have something in my mind when he says that. It'll be close to, you know, it'll be blue, but it could be, you know, somewhat different. So it's not perfect. Incidentally, a centimeter isn't perfect either when you use it. There's a little bit of margin of error and so on. So it is a measurement. And as I said before, we believe that the words were used in the French problem do really constitute for France a common language. All right, now, what is the majority grade? It is the middlemost of the grades, or the median. A majority of voters have assigned the candidate at least this grade, and a majority at most this grade. So, for example, if we got this distribution of grades, 8% excellent, 23% very good, 27% good, etc., then this candidate's grade would be good because 8 plus 23 plus 27, so 58% of voters assign at least a good and 69 at most a good. Okay, so the candidate's grade is good. Let me say this right here. Voters love the idea that candidates would get grades. So they know, you know, you're just acceptable or you're just good. No, it doesn't go beyond that. Don't forget. Okay, now, why do this? Well, it combats strategic voting for the following reason. Suppose a voter, you're a voter, you voted, but you voted very good in this list, and the candidate got good. So with the usual way of adding, what would you have imagined? You say, oh, gee, I made a mistake. I should have given an excellent because that would have helped move the score up. But with this, you can move from very good to excellent. It won't change anything. It's, you know, it's the 58% at least, you know, by going from very good up to excellent, it certainly doesn't change where the middle is. And obviously, this remark goes the other way. Suppose you thought the candidate was acceptable. In the ordinary voting, you would think, oh boy, I should, or giving points, you think I should have moved down. but it doesn't do any good. It doesn't change anything. So it is what we call strategy-proof in grading. This is quite important for wines. Now, a second property, which is immediately obvious, is that the majority grade respects a majority opinion. That is, if a majority gives a grade to a candidate, and the whole majority says this candidate is acceptable, then that's that candidate's grade. Now, it turns out that these properties uniquely define the method. There are many other properties that do also, which I'm not going to go into here today. But there are many characterizing properties. In fact, almost everything that we could think of that seemed reasonable, you could then use to characterize the method that we've proposed. Now, let's look at breaking ties in a voting situation, and then I'll show you how it works out in a wine situation. If a candidate's, I mean, so now let's assume two candidates have a good. So who's better between the two with a grade of good? Well, if a candidate's percentage better than the majority grade is greater than his or her percentage that is worse than the majority grade, then we say this is a majority grade plus. So let's say it's good. If a candidate's percentage of grades that is better than good is greater than, that are worse than good, then it's a good plus. And otherwise, if it's the other way around, it's a good minus. And now, what do we say? A good plus is obviously better than a good minus. And same thing for the others. And if we have two good pluses, then the one with the higher percentage of better than good is ranked ahead. And if there are two good minuses, the one with a higher number of worse than good is ranked behind. So this is presumably, with many voters, plenty enough to distinguish between everybody. All right, here's the description of the experiment. It was conducted in 3 of 12 voting bureaus of a small town called Orsay outside of Paris. I wish to emphasize this is not representative of France. Participants were well informed about this ahead of time in many different ways. And they cast their ballots in exactly the same conditions that they cast their official ballots. They first cast their official ballots in one part of the room, and then they came in another. And we tried to persuade them to participate, and 74% of them did participate. So we had quite a large rate of participation. This was, a lot of this was interviewed by a television person who was present, and so we have testimony that people were really very pleased about this experiment, about this way of voting. And here are the results. Now, I don't know, I know of one person here who followed these elections closely, but every French person to whom we've shown this, when we take out the names of Bayrou, Sarkozy, and Royal, will look at the distribution of these grades and be able to identify them. Does anybody care to try to do that? Now, let me quickly say that these are the rejected. We have recorded the blanks, but the blanks are interpreted as reject, and that voters were well informed about that. So if you wish, now, of course, look, one of the wonderful things here is Le Pen. You see that he was rejected by 74% of the vote. He's dead last with the system, whereas in the actual system, he was fourth. Anybody want to hazard a guess?
Oh, I think the first one is Bayrou.
Yes?
I think the second is Sarkozy, and the third is
Well, now that it's the almost. You reversed Royale and Sarkozy. You see, Sarkozy got the largest number of excellence, but also a very large number of lots of reject. He was very controversial, and these numbers say a lot. Now, in red are their grades. So you see, there were three goods. Voynet was the green candidate who ended up eighth officially. With us, she was a strong fourth. And I think that shows exactly what the electorate wanted. They're very conscious of ecological problems. They want, but they didn't want her as president. So you get a lot of information out of this. Now, here's the ranking. I actually had them in the ranking that we had. So you see, Bayrou was a good plus, Royale a good minus, Sarkozy a good minus, and on down. On the left is the national order. So Sarkozy was first, Royale second, Bayrou third, Le Pen fourth, and so on. These numbers, these give the actual order finished nationally. And you see, well, all right, I think... what else do I want to point out? I think this is very significant. The last is very significant. It shows really that France really did not want Le Pen. No question about this. And I guess I don't. Now I would like to make another remark, which. Well, we felt that voters, I mean, we in our estimation, voters want to be able to express themselves, okay? Now, there's a problem of giving too big a language because it becomes too fine. But we felt ahead of time, a lot of people saying, look, this candidate never. You know, I really just know, and in particular Le Pen. That's clear. And so that this seemed to respond to a very strong wish. Incidentally, I don't give you the statistics, but it was very interesting. The least used mark was excellent. The next least was very good. I mean, it just went up to reject. The distribution of the marks was very, very clear. Incidentally, I'm sure this would happen anywhere. I mean, that's how our politicians are looked at, and it would be very salutary for them to know it. Now, look, I'm going to look here in our experiment. Now, there are so many things I could tell you, but let me just again say, in our experiment, Bayrou was first, Royale was second. So I'm sticking to this experiment, and I asked the... question. Could strategic voting, could voters have manipulated who would have preferred to have Royale winner, could they have manipulated and made her the winner rather than Bayrou? And the answer is yes, of course, if there were many of them, they could. But now, if, on the other hand, you look at those voters who graded Royale above Bayrou, and if they did as I will show you in a second, then they would have failed. So here's the way to read this slide. There are 2.8% of all the voters who gave an acceptable to Royale and either a poor or to reject to Bayrou, okay? And let's say here, there is 6.9 who gave a very good to Royale and a good to Bayrou, and so on, okay? Now, the first point is that, of course, here we assume, okay, they preferred Royale to Bayrou, but, I mean, they didn't think much of either one. Would they be tempted to cheat and to exaggerate? And, you know, we say no, none of them did that. Please look at this sentence here. Polls estimated at 20% the number of people who gave strategic votes different than what their convictions were. Okay, so now we'll assume that 33% of those who said Royal was excellent and Bayrou was very good would vote strategically. How can they vote strategically? By lowering Bayrou below good. But it doesn't serve them to go any further, because as soon as you go down, that's the only thing that will change. You go any further, it's not going to change things, right? So you can cheat, but there's no point to going very far. And everything is in this light. Now, one of the things to see right away is that the voter who can raise one candidate's grade cannot lower the others, and vice versa. So you can cheat one direction, but you can't in both. Now, incidentally, when you're using points and summing, none of this is true. Any one person changes, he has an effect on the result. And so if you do as we have postulated, and of course, this 9.2% here, if they either put Royal excellent or very good and Bayrou one of these, they can't do anything to change. There's no way they can influence matters at all. So this is resistant to change, and we have several theorems having to do with characterizing the method and showing why it is the least manipulable possible. Okay, do I have another few minutes? This, incidentally, what got this started was wine. Because I wrote a series of popular articles in the French Scientific American 5 years ago, and as a result, a very well-known oenologist called me and said, look, I think you're... techniques would have something to do and could really help in our procedures for grading and wines for competitions. I don't think that these methods are very good, and so on and so forth. And he came and we spoke, and then finally Rida and I decided, well, let's look at this problem. And this was very, very important, I think, because it gave us another mindset. Everybody since 1299 has thought that the only way you can think about ranking candidates is what? Listing them one after the other as an input. But when you have wines, you don't somehow, it liberated us. And so we started looking at that problem, and of course very soon we saw what we felt had to be done for that, and then of course that it goes on and is applicable elsewhere. Now, it has been used, this majority judgment has been used in this French wine competition known as Les Citadelles du Vin in June 2006 and 2007, which is in the Bordeaux region. Both times we're talking about 1,250 different wines. It was used in parallel with the usual system. The usual system, I will show you the rating form that is used. But the argument of this oenologist was to say that the sum of points, they use a point system, which you'll see in a second, misses the point because it has difficulty in detecting exceptional wines by overly favoring those that are taste-wise correct. Secondly, he said that, moreover, of course, he felt that the quality of a wine is not the sum of individual qualities. It's something that goes well beyond. And that, in effect, really respectable judges do not judge in that way. What they do is taste, decide the final grade they want, and then attribute the points so that they add up correctly. Well, here is the form that they use. I'm sorry, I've had to, just to get things together on one slide. So the first column says excellent, very good, good, passable, inadequate, mediocre, bad. And for each of these, I think there are 14 or 15 constituents, there are points associated with this. And what a judge is supposed to do is check, well, in this case, as you see, I've checked very good here for limpidity, excellent for nuance, very good for intensity and so on, and that gives you altogether a score of 90. The sum of all the first column is 100, the last sum is obviously 0, so you get a score of 0 to 100. And in our experiment, it goes like this. For you, this wine is excellent, very good, good, passable, inadequate, mediocre, or bad. In wine, there are typically 5 judges, and for any wine, the grades may be, of course, listed from best to worst. Here's an example. Bordeaux, very good, 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 bad. And so, of course, median is good, so its grade is good. However, sometimes there may be an even number of judges. So there isn't any middle. And in that case, we say you must give the lower of the two middle. So if we had here 6 judges, the grade for this Arbois would be passable. Now, why? Because I would compare these two for the following reason. We say that in this example, the Arbois should rank ahead of the Bon, because all of the Arbois grades belong to the middle interval of Bon's grades. So look, here's the Bon, and here's the Arbois. Take the middle interval of the Bon's one, and the Arbois, I'm sorry, is that the way I'm saying it? Which is better? Yeah, and Arbois is right smack in the middle. What is that telling us? There's a much greater consensus around the grade given to Bon than there is about Arbois. To Arbois than there is about Bon, excuse me. I've got it here. The Arbois grades are either good and passable. They're all good or passable. And the middle interval here is very good and very good to inadequate. So everything in Arbois is in the middle interval of Bon. Conclusion, Arbois is better. Why? Greater consensus. Consensus is what majority decision is about. We're looking for a consensus on which is the best. And we say that is the basic principle. That gives us the lower middle. Therefore, if we want to rank 3 wines, let's say it is an Anjou, a Bourgogne, and a Chablis, suppose they're all good. Well, what do? Well, look, now we know they each have a grade of good, but we want to differentiate between the 3 wines. So what do? Well, we know they're already good, so the grade of good has been given all the information it can give. We drop it and apply the same procedure. Now, the secondary grade is good for Anjou, good for Bourgogne, passable for Chablis, Chablis last. But now we have to do the same thing again. We'll drop the goods for Arjou and Bourgogne. We find both are now, as a tertiary grade, very good. So we do it again. And what do we find? Arjou is, now it's passable, mediocre. And so Arjou is better than Bourgogne, which, of course, we know already is better than Chablis. Now, this idea and this procedure is... It is from this that we deduced what you do for the voting when there are many, many, many judges, where you can do it in terms of percentage and you don't have to do to this painstaking tie-breaking rule. Now, from that, as you can see, any 2 competitors can be ranked unless their grades are exactly the same. Otherwise, you'll always get a difference. And I will finish by saying that, as usual in life, you think you've invented something different, but somebody had the idea essentially before, and that was Sir Francis Galton. Galton had the germ of that idea in 1907, and he applied it in the context of what we call the budgeting problem. He said, a certain class of problems do not yet appear to be solved according to scientific rules, though they are of much importance and a frequent occurrence. One, a jury has to assess damages. Second, the council of a society has to fix on a sum of money suitable for some purpose. Each voter has equal authority. How can the right conclusion be reached, considering that there may be as many different estimates as there are members? That conclusion is clearly not the average of the estimates, which would give a voting power to cranks in proportion to their crankiness. I wish to point out that the estimate to which least objection can be raised is the middlemost estimate. Every other estimate is condemned by a majority of voters as being either too high or too low. Thank you.
Time for a question or two. Are there any? Yeah, yep.
Do you think that voters will react negatively to the fact that at its base, only one vote really counts in the system?
I didn't. Repeat, please.
Do you think that voters will react negatively to the fact that at its base, only one vote really counts in the system?
I still didn't understand, out of what? Oh, well, I'm sorry. One vote does not matter in the system, does it?
I mean,
after all, it's got to be the middle one, and everybody somehow, I don't think so, no. What is being used today? The average. So it's, right? And now you're substituting the median for the average, if you wish, so except that it's a finite language. Whereas if you're doing sums, you're getting something different.
I guess that in an average, each voter has defined weight in the sense that they can move the average, however little it may be. But in this sense, only one vote actually decides what the weight is.
Well, look, you can't say that one vote decides because, how do I put this? If you drop other voters, or if you drop him, or if you drop other voters, you're going to change the outcome. All voters have exactly the same influence on the final outcome. Yes?
This is a wonderful theoretical enterprise. Most of us here, would love to see it implemented on a grander scale because it has many properties. And can you imagine a scenario in which this could be adopted?
Obviously, we think about this. Our feeling is that what we would like, what we're going to try to do, and we've started to try to do. First of all, I'll give you one example. There's a thing called the aggregation in France. And this is a competitive exam. You study for a year. You go up before a jury. The jury is forced to rank you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, okay? Everybody's got to be ranked until a certain cutoff, and that's finished, and the ranking is announced. We are now in the process of trying to persuade the aggregation in public law to adopt this method. And he is very interested. So, secondly, I think of departments. You're going to appoint one person, let's say, or maybe two, or maybe three, it doesn't matter, but you're going to appoint somebody. And if you cannot reach a consensus and you need to go to a vote, then I say use this. Because you're going to be combating strategic behavior. And you know well there is strategic behavior. It's well in your experience. So I say, do that. Then the wine people, I mean, this oenologist, he's already put it into his book. He feels this is the right way to do it. Then we're going to try to sell this to the skating community. And what the hope is that as this gets, and to the musical community and so on, and as this gets slowly, you know, used here and there and proves its value, then hopefully we can get to politics. Now, the problem with politics is, of course, that the actors are the referees. And the ones who are in power who won are those who won with the old rules. It's very difficult to get them to be interested. Now, the ones who are interested, they're the ones who've lost. Now, Baihu is very pleased by this result. I mean, I know him. He's called me in for consultations and things of this sort. So this result, he thinks, is absolutely wonderful. But Sarkozy, I suspect, is not very happy with this result at all. Okay? So I think you have to start with little places and places that are willing to experiment. And as I say, I make a plea to you. I hope that in your departments, you'll try this. And I think the procedure would be to say, okay, we must decide on a common language. What is our common language? That's the debate. And once you've got the common language, try it. You know, and this would be a way of look, you know, if everybody does that, we're just back to usual voting, right? Okay, so we're in a stream case. But here's an example. Sorry, that's not the one. You know, the example I showed you before. Here, where you're getting, I don't know how many, what the total number of people, about 15% are cheating as much as they can in order to, or 20% of all the voters, and they couldn't upset the result. So it's not one. Now, technically speaking, it is strategy proof in grading if you believe the following thing. You're a judge, and you say this is worth let's say it's a point system, 9. And if it is true that the further away from 9 it is, the less you like it, and we're doing wines, where I have it under authority that nobody knows what they're tasting, so you can't, you know, there aren't these things, then you can't cheat, okay? Now, in politics, you can't do that because, you know, there are these other things going on. However, I think, and now we're talking, and not mathematics, we're talking about, you know, we're talking about this nebulous business of modeling, mathematics, and psychology and other things, and how do people behave? I think people want to answer the question they're posed. They don't like to cheat. Of course, there are a few that like to cheat, obviously. There are those who like to play around. But, you know, the vast majority, I don't think, they feel better in being able to say what they really think. So, I think it should work quite well because of that. And I think the experiment, you know, is a step in that direction. Clearly, it's the first time they used it. So, you know, maybe in time they're going to have different behaviors. But of course, in time, if this is used, then this will change the behavior of the politicians. Because today, what is the object? Today, the object is to have a bit over 50%. And I was very struck, I was saying this at dinner, we were talking the other night, that in the French presidential election this year, there was a, you know, the television, there were various television appearances of the major candidates where the major candidates appeared in a form like this with supposedly randomly picked or whatever citizens, which of course was doubtful. But the point is that the questions were of the nature, I have a broken leg, what are you going to do for me? And that was the nature of the answer too, I'm going to do this for you. And I say, no, I think it's possible to address the citizen the following question, what's good for the country? And address the question directly on paper. This is where I think Lul made a very deep impression on me. And I think that having a statement which people are asked to respond to, yes, many in great numbers will respond to that. But of course, now we're not talking about, you know, talking about something else, and so I don't know exactly what, but I do feel that this is true.
Are there any others? Yeah, in the back.
Is it the weakness of the, is it a weakness of the model that when it happens that votes, well, please accumulate a line to the, of the spectrum? For example, politicians get very low grades and ones high grades. Is it a weakness that influences the objective outcome?
Well, I'm not sure. I cannot tell you that I have experimental evidence to say that. That you're saying wines get high grades and politicians get low grades.
Well, uniform grades and better.
But look, if it's in common, it doesn't matter. Do you see what I mean? That is, if there is a sense of, I mean, again, I come back, very essential to our notions is that you have a common language. And we do develop this idea in somewhat more detail than what we're writing. But it's, the, you know, this has to do with the very ancient problem of that we all know about, where you have professors who give very harsh grades and others who are very generous. And so you get these imbalances if you want to try to get to evaluate a student over the course of his entire or her entire career, but over a year or whatever. And that of course, is, that would, you know, the extent to which people grade, have a different interpretation of the language, that will be a weakness. I don't know if I've answered your question, but I...
One here, and then one more up there, and then... So you're...
Yeah, the system strikes me as a refinement on approval voting.
Approval voting is a particular case in which you have a language of two words. Now, the problem with approval voting, first of all, I don't think that's enough. Secondly, approval voting, you're not giving voters very much with which to express themselves, right? It's very meager what you're giving them. Secondly, I would say I'm sorry, I hope you don't think this will be arrogant in some sense, but the trouble with all of the analyses for and against approval voting is that they've been done in the context of the traditional model. It's not viewed as a grading system. It's viewed as a voting system, okay? Now, and so what are their claims? Well, they make claims like approval voting has a tendency to choose the Condorcet candidate. Well, of course, that's false to begin with. Or another claim is made, approval voting is completely indeterminate. It's very nice mathematically. What it says is that you can have in approval voting, again, you see, it departs from the notion that you have a rank order in your mind. Everybody has a rank order in your mind. And so what they will do if they're approval voting is they will choose a cutoff point somewhere and give ones, they'll vote for all those above and not for those below. Now, it's been shown that if you could take one profile and produce any order whatsoever because of these cutoffs. But that's ridiculous. It's a very nice mathematical thing. It's lovely, but it is ridiculous in any true sense of voting. There are some candidates you really like, and there's, you know, I don't like the rest. You're never going to just place it anywhere. On the contrary, where you place the cutoff is the whole business, and that amounts to a great deal. So that's nonsense as a practical matter. It's lovely. Otherwise, it's a lovely observation. But I think as a practical model, it just doesn't mean a thing. So just the last thing, and I think that, frankly, I've always thought of the proof of voting. There's not one theorem in approval voting which gives you any sense that this is a reasonable way to vote. All of it is very nice seat-of-the-pants arguments, reasonable arguments, but nothing really definite. Finally, there is an analysis, except in the case of so-called dichotomous preferences. That, of course, but that's the only exception.
Okay, last one.
Do you think that there are...
You want to rescale afterwards? Is that what you're saying? This has been suggested often. I think it's tampering in a way that I would not. That I find. It's very arbitrary, and I dislike the idea.
Okay, so I'll remind you the last talk in the series is tomorrow at 4:45 in this room, and let's thank the speaker again.